Hi, it's good to have your company. My name is Simon Smart. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Well, Peter Hitchens is a conservative columnist and sometime foreign correspondent from the UK. He's well known in his own right, but also as the younger brother of the late Christopher Hitchens, who was a commentator, writer, public intellectual, who before his death in 2011 was a prominent and vocal atheist. Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, caused quite a stir around the world when it was released. But in response, Peter Hitchens wrote a book called The Rage Against God, How Atheism Led Me to Faith. As a young man, Peter Hitchens was also a committed non-believer, but these days is a Christian. Peter Hitchens was in Australia for the Festival of Dangerous Ideas, and I caught up with him in a rather noisy lobby of his hotel, where we had a wide-ranging discussion on things from belief to morality, drug-taking, and the direction things are heading in the West. It's fair to say that Hitchens is not all that optimistic about that. Peter Hitchens, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Now, in the secular public space, no one seems to want to talk about morality. It's too divisive, gives people grounds for judging others and so on. But you say, without any qualification, that drug taking is morally wrong. Now, even though it's an awkward conversation, why is it important for morality to have a place in public debate?
Because if morality isn't agreed by everybody, then it doesn't work. And this was first rammed home to me when I lived in the Soviet Union. Very simple example. I was brought up to hold doors open for people when either if they were coming behind me on a swing door or if they were coming the other way. I tried to do this in Moscow on the metro there, where they have very, very heavy doors against the bitter weather. And the Russians would see me doing this, and they would look at me as if I were playing a trick on them. No one ever held doors open. It was considered absurd. In fact, one person looked at me and said, "Вы не русский человек," which means you're not a Russian person, obviously, because it was such an odd thing to do. Same thing, say, in modern Britain, which is nearly as ill-mannered and immoral as the Soviet Union was then. I'll be on a crowded train, and there'll be somebody coming the other way as I'm heading up towards the buffet car, and I'll stand aside and let them go. The people behind me will then think I'm having a heart attack or something and just push on by without any understanding that anyone is going to make way for them. Once these simple rules are, obviously some people may not value them, I happen to, but once these things are not generally understood, they don't operate. You can't have a morality which doesn't operate two ways for everybody. And if there is no fundamental agreement about where it comes from, there won't be any such thing. There'll be a series of practical, basic, common decency rules which people will often abide by simply because they're scared of what will happen to them if they don't, which is not a very good basis for morality. But unless you've got a common understanding of where it comes from, what it is, it won't even work on a practical basis.
Yes, and is this part of your concern that we've lost the kind of basis upon which we might agree upon morality, and then you're left with maybe common courtesy or totalitarianism?
The great problem with that is that people say, "Oh, the golden rules are right, do as you would be done by," but it doesn't actually mean do as you would be done by. It means appear to do as you would be done by. Which, as anyone, for instance, who's ever been on the receiving end of rough office politics will know, people often don't actually do what they appear to be doing, and it's often in people's interest to appear to be much nicer than they are. And the evil done in secret is very common, and without something beyond common decency, there'll be a lot more of it.
Yeah, I can't help feeling that your work in this area exposes a symptom of a much deeper issue in Western culture, and then we see it in our approach to drug taking, for instance, the very permissive lack of enforcement and so on, that we see something of a modern parable about what we really worship, which is unrestricted freedom of the individual. Do you think that's partly what's going on?
Well, I think that's dignifying it a lot. I call it selfism. It's the sovereignty of the self, the autonomy of the self, which as soon as you call it by its proper name sounds as unattractive as it is. I think that the problem with selfism or selfishness or whatever you wish to term it the problem with this sort of selfishness is that it will exist at all times and in all places unless there's something very powerful to restrain it. There are some religions which are quite worldly in their nature and their worship, which have been quite careful not to come into too much conflict with it. The problem with Christianity, the difficulty about Christianity, the reason why Chesterton said that it had been found to be difficult and not tried, is because it places a very heavy weight on selfishness. And the collapse of Christianity, which in my view followed the First World War in Western Europe and has weakened everywhere else which existed ever since, has allowed in a great deal of selfishness, which has often been dignified by its practitioners with all kinds of grandiose claims about human rights and freedom. But they are grandiose claims, and they are designed to cover up the fact that what's really being done is the enthronement of the self. And the enthronement of the self, of course, means that those who are richer and more powerful and better off do quite well. In fact, it's never been such a good time, I think, in what used to be Christendom, to be rich or powerful, than it is now.
There's not much restraint.
Not much restraint, and lots of rewards for failing to restrain yourself, and very few penalties.
You're listening to Life and Faith and my interview with Peter Hitchens, the conservative columnist and author from the UK. Now, this argument of yours to restrain drug use, I'm sure you're getting plenty of reaction to that. But there are similar debates around things like alcohol, poker machines, pornography and that sort of thing. People don't like having their freedoms restricted. But at the same time,
the word freedom again, you see. It's not really a freedom. And there are freedoms which are important to sort of society, the freedom of thought, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. These are freedoms which could be and should be protected by law. But the freedom to drink or smoke or pill yourself into a stupor, how can that be called a freedom in the same breath? It's an extraordinary failure to distinguish between things which are very different.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the definition
of freedom... language
is
very important here. Yeah. One of the things which actually shocked me when I began to discuss this was the way in which the drug lobby portrayed themselves as liberators of the human soul. In fact, in many ways, they're the opposite. The human soul is dulled by self-stupefaction. And it also makes the drug user more complacent, more satisfied with his circumstances, more pliable, more ready to accede to the outrages of authority. I would have thought it was an enemy of freedom, not in any way an ally of it.
There are lots of costs associated with this sort of thing, and what you're arguing for has a bit of a feel of the love your neighbour. Is that part of it?
Well, of course it does, but I'm not really arguing for anything, I'm afraid. I have stopped doing that because it would only make me unhappy to do so. I regard myself as the obituarist of my own country. So anybody watching the national suicide program of the United Kingdom, Great Britain, Northern Ireland, they say, well, we are determined to continue with it till the end, until we sink giggling or screaming into the sea, depending on how it ends. And there's nothing that anybody can do to stop it. I wish to record truthfully what happened, to describe accurately and in plain English how it took place, so that anybody coming afterwards can look at it carefully, see what actually happened, and decide for themselves whether they want to follow the same pathway. Not many places have actually gone as far down as we have. But I don't. People say, oh, you campaign for tougher laws on drugs. Well, I would like it if Britain had more effective laws against drug possession, but I don't have any illusion for a moment this is going to happen, because the mood of the times is against it, the great bulk of the academy and of the media are against it. I see absolutely no prospect that my arguments are going to win, even though I know perfectly well that I'm right.
The tougher laws, though, might they not hurt the most vulnerable people, given that we see the impact of drugs on especially poorer people?
The purpose of law is not to go around and punish people and throw them into prison. The purpose of law is to deter people from doing stupid, damaging things, often self-damaging things. And of course, all crime is in a way caused by law. If we didn't have any crimes, we wouldn't have to have these tedious police forces and courts and prisons and stuff. But the truth is that we have them because we can't rely on the human conscience to restrain ourselves from doing things which are stupid. And at certain times, we can rely on it less than others. We're in an era of very weak conscience, so we need more laws. And one of my fears is that leaving drugs out of this, that the weakness of conscience, the unwillingness of people to forge moral chains upon themselves, as Edmund Burke warned, will lead to a stronger and stronger state. But in this case, you say, of course, some poor people might suffer from the application of the law, but nothing like as much as they're going to suffer from the readily available drugs among them and the disasters which those will bring into almost every home in which they're used.
You talk about self-restraint and delayed gratification being replaced by hedonism and pleasure-seeking. There's a whole lot of consequences associated with
that. Well, this is just a description of events as they take place.
What are the consequences of it, though?
We're seeing them. And the thing is that those of us who, like me, are fortunate enough to be pretty well off and to live in the pleasanter parts of town and still to be able to afford our children in disciplined schools, and things like that, we see it less than others. I'm very conscious all the time that as I avoid it, that I am avoiding it, and that I have a responsibility to try and save other people from it if I possibly can. And for many years, I thought that I was campaigning to alter it. I then found that the battle was simply unwinnable. So as I say, I now describe it, but I do feel a great sense of shame that there's nothing I can do to protect or save people from this. But in my country, there are large parts of any city in which lawlessness is pretty much endemic, in which it's accepted that there is no real order. It's not. Everyone goes on about organized crime and mafias, and well, these things are obviously bad, and the state needs to act against them. For most people, the breakdown of order means that when they're old, they don't walk along a shopping street because an 11 or 12-year-old on a bike will ride along and knock them over. Or when they get home, the same 11-year-old or another one will kick a football against their bedroom wall for 12 hours at a stretch. Or if there's something at all peculiar or unusual about them, if they're a little odd. There's a terrible case which you can look up on the internet of a lady called Fiona Pilkington and her daughter Francesca. The daughter was, she had educational special needs, I think, would be the polite way of putting it. She was a bit unusual, and as a result, groups of youths would gather around their house night after night, pelting it with eggs and shouting rude things at them, and they would call the police, and the police wouldn't come, or would come and would go away again, and effectively ignored it, until in the end, Fiona Pilkington's heart broke, and she drove out into the countryside, and with the two of them in the car, she set fire to the car and killed herself and the girl. This is a more, how shall I say, strongly delineated example of what's happening to many, many thousands of people in our country who are at the mercy of neighbours who don't love their neighbours. That's the worst of it. There are all kinds of other things. If you're a child in one of our less well-favoured schools, then you have no chance of learning anything because the classrooms are out of control. The teachers can't control them and they have no authority with which to do it. Where would it come from? Who would back them up? The person who's in danger, if a teacher tries to discipline a pupil, the person who's in danger is the teacher.
That's a bleak picture you're painting there.
You can buy your way out of it, and most of our elite do, and so that it doesn't touch them personally, so they don't care about it.
Well, that was conservative columnist and foreign correspondent and author Peter Hitchens discussing the negative currents of Western society today. Join me next time on Life and Faith when we continue our chat with Peter Hitchens, focusing on belief and why it was he turned from atheism to Christianity. It's a fascinating story. I'll catch you then.